Well, welcome to session two on crime and justice. I'm Dan Lewis. Most of the time I'm a professor at Northwestern University in the School of Social Policy, but for this week I'm part of the teaching staff, and next week too, part of the teaching staff up here, trying to sort out the crime and justice problem within the context of the theme for holding this year of general justice. Some of you were here last time. I apologize, I was a little ill yesterday. Couldn't do the second session on time. And what we did in the first session was ask what the crime problem was in the United States. And I showed the people that were here a little chart that showed that for 100% of the burglaries and robberies that take place in a major metropolitan city, only about 30% are reported to the police. Only another 5% of those are prosecuted by the court system, and ultimately only 1% of the people who commit those crimes end up in prison. So that there's a tremendous drop in criminal justice system from the amount of crime that there is in the United States to the amount of punishment that we met out as a society. And I asked the question of the group that was here then, what's the crime problem? Is it there's too much crime in the first place? Is it that citizens don't report crimes to the police in a timely fashion? Is it that the police don't catch anybody? Is it the prosecutors don't prosecute anybody? Or ultimately, is it that nobody spends any time in prison? And we chatted about that as a group and didn't come to any consensus, which is, of course, the Holden way. To begin the second session, there is a consensus in the society. And I think the consensus in the society is that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that if more people were punished, less crime would be committed. And that if we could figure out a way to get citizens to report, get police to arrest, get prosecutors to prosecute, get judges to sentence, we would be a long way towards solving the crime problem in this country. That's what we, in the academic business, call the deterrence theory. That is to say, if the punishment is severe and if it's swift, then a rational person won't do the thing that's going to get them punished. And that's the kind of theory that has motivated most of the things that we've tried to do in the United States over the last 50 years when it comes to doing something about crime. We hire more policemen. We try to get people to report more crimes. We build more prisons. We create sentences that take discretion away from judges. We try to create more deterrence. The two pieces that theorists that talk about this thing stress in the deterrence theory is that punishment must be certain. That is to say, if you do it, you're going to get it. And it must be severe. That is to say, it must be a high enough cost so that it's not worth it to steal the car, rob the person, burglarize the home, whatever. And most people then go on to try to figure out how to make that punishment more certain, and we keep making our punishments more severe. And as I mentioned at some point over the last couple of days, currently in the United States, we have more people in prison than ever before in our history. And not only that, but as a percentage of the total population, it's high. So that means that not only are there more of them absolutely, but as a percentage of the total population, it's very high. In fact, one in every 35 American men is under some kind of correctional sentence today. So we're punishing severely, and yet, as I don't have to go around the room and find out, most of us don't feel like the crime problem is under control very much. And what I'd like to talk a little bit about today is what I laughingly call the missing link in the deterrence theory, which is information. We've been used to watching Barnaby Jones and Perry Mason and lots of police shows on TV, so we have a notion of police work as something that is carried on by people called detectives who go around interviewing people after the crime has happened and trying to figure out who done it and then making an arrest over after a brilliant investigation. But that's premised on the idea that there's information available about who did do it and that the information is timely and available. And the little chart that I put on the board for you is hopefully going to explode myth number two. Myth number one, we talked about last week in terms of the only 1% of the people who have committed crimes being in jail. Myth number two is that there's information available in the criminal justice system that would allow the police to do a good job. And what this chart shows you is for different kinds of crimes, interpersonal violence means assaults and rapes. Robbery is somebody putting a gun or a knife at you and taking your money. Theft is stealing property. Burglary is going into your house and stealing property. Larceny is taking something from you. And car theft, we all know what car theft is. And the first column shows you the percentage of those crimes that are reported by citizens or that are directly seen by the police. So when it comes to interpersonal violence, we see a fairly high rate of 40%, for robbery 49%, theft 35%, burglary 45%, larceny 22%, and car theft. We're all very eager to report when our cars get stolen because we're all insured, so we need to do that to collect our insurance. The next column, percentage known race, means the simple matter of knowing what color the person was that did the violence to you or stole from you, of those that were reported. And here the numbers start to begin to get a little depressing. In only 38% of the cases of interpersonal violence did we even know what color the person was that had done the evil deed to us. 43% in robbery. Now, what's important to recognize here is that in these kinds of what we call personal crimes, there was it's a crime against your person, these are pretty high. Okay, 38 and 43. That means in almost half the cases, we know something about the person that did it. The person that was victimized or the policeman himself can identify the race of the person that did it to them. It isn't much, right? When we get to theft, we're down to 18%. And when we get to the property crimes, it's infinitesimal. That is to say, and it's fairly obvious, I mean, you're not around when these things happen, so it's very hard to know who did it, right? So we're down to 2%, 1%, and 3% for the property crimes down here. Then we go over here to a positive identification. That is to say, somebody can say to you, it was the guy down the street that lives two doors down, it was Joe, it was Ralph, I can tell you who did it. The numbers are getting even smaller. Again, about 17% in terms of the interpersonal violence, only 7% for the robberies, 1% for the thefts, and less than 1% for the rest of the property crimes. So if you can't even identify who the person is at the beginning of the investigation, it's almost impossible to find them. Now the police have sold us, in a way, a bad bill of goods over the last 20 years by giving us the feeling that they can do it. That if we just report it, they can find out who did it through their investigative kinds of activities. but their investigative kinds of activities are woefully lacking. Police departments, I mean, they're organized in lots of different ways. But in terms of catching people, there's a patrol division, and that's the people that you see driving around every day in your neighborhood who answer calls when people call in. And there's a detective bureau, which is in charge of the investigation. When it comes to this type of crimes, the personal kinds of crimes, the overwhelming majority of the arrests that are made, and here we do have, you know, a good chance, fairly good chance, gets a little weak over here, of finding people, the overwhelming majority of those arrests, something like 80% of them, are made by the patrol division. That is to say, the guy that answers the call gets to the house, and the guy is still there. Or, as we say in the business, they're known but flown. So that they'll say, I saw the kid that was in here, it's little Herbie Jones from down the street, and then the patrol division can go find him and pick him up. Or they can give a good piece of identification. But it's the patrol division and not the detective division that is able to find the people. I have a wonderful statistic here for you. I don't want to get too deeply into this. But just to depress you even more, in a major city, I think it was Kansas City, the police department averaged one felony conviction. That's to say, after they caught him, they still got to convict him, right? For every 14,720 patrol hours, or one conviction per 7 work years. And the point of bringing that up, and we'll talk a little bit about the court system in a second. The point of bringing that up is, with all the good intentions and hard work in the world, if you don't know the very basic information about the person, you can't catch them. There's no way to catch them because there's no way to find them. And if you can't do it right away, almost immediately, in terms of the person that answers the call, it's impossible. And we were talking about being burglarized. I mean, it's the perfect example. You get home, not from Holden. Your hostels will be fine when you come home. You get home from Holden, and somebody's got the stereo and taken the jewelry. Mm-hmm. And you call the police, and they come over, and I mean, rarely, but in your case, they actually dusted for fingerprints, probably to make you feel good.
I was furious because they didn't clean up.
Right. and that's basically it. That'll stay an open file. And if there isn't any, if you didn't see them or there's no physical evidence, I remember once my car got broken into in Chicago, and the poor son of a gun left his wallet. He was sort of looking under the seats there. I don't know what he was doing, but his papers slipped out of his, and they could catch him then. But if there isn't any kind of either physical evidence or direct contact, there's no way the police can catch him unless they'll make an arrest 6 months later on some other charge, and the guy, in order to get a lesser sentence, will make a deal and say, well, I also did that house over there, and this house over there.
Plea bargaining, huh?
Right. And all, yeah. And if they, if the police can clear more open cases with the arrest, they like that better. So that makes them more anxious to cut a deal with the person. The point of this is not to badmouth the police, of course, because it's not the police's fault. The point of this is they don't, especially for the property crimes. And remember, for those of you who weren't here last time, for every one of these personal crimes, there's 9 of these. So it's by far the overwhelming majority of crime in the United States are property crimes. There is simply no information about the person that did it that you can give to the police. Either because you're aware you didn't see it, or yeah.
You get the fingerprint, then what?
By and large, not very good. Occasionally, the person, for the fingerprint business to work, there has to be, A, you have to be able to get a good, clean set, and B, the person has to be on file at the FBI. For so many of these crimes, we're talking about 16 to 20-year-olds who either aren't adult and therefore not in the FBI files, or are simply so young as to either haven't been caught or to be handled in juvenile court where their fingerprints are not available. So, I mean, it's a nice thought, and I wouldn't want you to tell them not to fingerprint, because you never know when something might come out of it. But overwhelmingly, it doesn't produce any kind of useful information, and especially in the property crimes. Let's talk a little bit about, yeah, go ahead.
Dan, I was going to say, what do you think about the sting operations that they have, where the police or the FBI sets up a store and buys all the stolen goods?
I think, though, I mean, I'm for anything that makes a dent in this thing. The point that I'm going to weave my way to today, or that we'll weave our way to today, is if we want to think about getting justice and reducing crime, maybe we as citizens are going to have to look other places than the traditional criminal justice system, because it's just such an unbelievably long haul to get where you want to go. I mean, we're talking, you know, if you just look below this line, less than 10% of the time is there a positive identification on the person that committed the crime. This kind of violence here, the reason it's so much higher, is because often the person is known to the victim. And I'm sure some of you have heard these statistics before, in murder cases, well over 60% of the time, the person is least acquainted with the person that kills them. Often, about 25% of the time, they're blood related, and another 9% over that, so that's about 35% of the time, they're lovers or friends or something like that. So when you're looking at interpersonal violence, and for rape, it's quite high too, up to about 50% of the time, people are acquainted, the victim and the offender. So the reason is both reported, and these figures are significantly higher, is because you know the person that's doing the terrible thing to you. And you can make an identification if you're not too scared. There are, and only in about 25% of these interpersonal violence cases is what we call felony violence. That is to say, and that's not an insignificant amount, about a quarter of the time, it is a stranger, and it's in the process of a crime being committed that the violence takes place. So that's not insignificant, but 60, 70% of the time, you're acquainted with the person that is doing the terrible thing to you. And often in murders, the person just sits there after they've done the awful deed. They don't try to flee, or if they flee, everybody in the world, in the neighborhood or in the apartment building knows, you know, that it was the husband or the boyfriend or whatever. So these are clearable through good, and it takes good police work to track the person down, but they know who it is. The robberies, this is the least likely kind of crime where you do know the person. This is the kind of classic stranger who holds you up. So while you can identify their race, the numbers go way down when it comes to positive identification, because that's all, you know, it was a Spanish man, or it was a white man, it was a black man, it was whatever. But often this is the kind of crime that's done between strangers. So that the police are in a position to find the person that's done it when the person is known to the victim. But if they're not, then we're all in trouble, to the extent that the police are just, as anybody else would be, terribly incapable of tracking down people when they don't have a clue, as it were, about who they are, where they came from, or anything else. So that if we want the, if we want to pursue this deterrence theory, and it's the kind of theory that we all have grown up with, we've got to think about information. And if we're going to think about information, then we got to think that that dependency that we've had over all these years on the criminal justice system. That is to say, it's their responsibility. It's a professional's responsibility. Let's not worry about it ourselves. The police will take care of it. It's going to leave us with very, very high crime rates, because the first thing we need to do, which is to tell the police something about the person that did it to us, we can't do. And it's not our fault, it's that we weren't there. And, you know, the better the criminal, the less likely they're going to be to leave something around that's going to let us know who they are. So the police spend a lot of time kind of doing administrative kinds of things to sort of manage the huge amount of crime that's there and categorize it and try to clear as much of it as possible. But it's a very, very tall order because the information simply is not available from the victim to let the officer do very much to find the person. 35% of the murders are cleared at the site, and another 20% of the murders are known but flown. Assaults, which are the most common personal kind of crime, that is to say somebody punches you in the face or does, you know, bodily violence to you. Something like 65 to 80% of those are done by acquaintances. So again, there's a way to find out who it is. Questions, comments before we...
What's the last column on the
right? Oh, that's the number of people that were in the study. Oh. As an N. Yeah. I just put that into you. I don't know why I put it in there. See that there's some, these estimates are based on some fairly substantial, and these are national estimates too, done from national studies of crime. Yeah.
Why is it that lie detector tests cannot be used in court here? Or is it the circumstances where the lie detector test is given?
No, I think it's mostly that we're not real sure about their reliability. And there's a lot of question about whether they are both valid and reliable in terms of the kinds of information they give out. I'm not an expert on it, but that's my sense of what keeps it down.
Yeah, we had a homicide in our house. It was rented, and one person out of 20 failed the lie detector test. The detective says they can't use it in court, even though they believe he is the one
right. Who
did it.
Right.
So consequently, and the individual also left the state shortly after that and stayed away for a year. They said he can't prove it.
Yeah.
So it's all
homicide. Right. And
that's
not uncommon. I mean, unless you can really settle it immediately, somebody confesses or they're eyewitnesses, it's very tough to come up with the kind of evidence that would take in court. And it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't have to be that fancy. I mean, a huge amount of it is just to have no real evidence that places the person at the scene of the crime, as they say in the biz. So that the police are just working with very, very little information when it comes to this kind of situation. And as I said, you know, if you stay below that my little red line, 90% of the crime is in these categories where you've got less than 1% positive identifications of the kind of persons. So one of the things that this means to me, and one of the ways that it relates to the theme, is we wish we could get it out of our mind. We wish we could hand it over to somebody else to take care of it for us, and that's, of course, what we do. But when we do that, we relegate the crime problem to people who can't really tackle it very well because of this informational problem. And it gets even more depressing when we get into the court, but I didn't want to leap into that until we had spent a little more time on this. Yeah.
Before we were, the other day we were distinguishing between robbery and burglary, and now we've got theft and larceny up there too. I want to cut the line between them.
Well, they're different categories.
Yeah, me and Tommy.
Yeah. Larceny means the loss of property through stealth or stealing. You don't know, I was using an example the other day when I was going home from Michigan and I couldn't find the $80 that I had in my pocket. I could report that and say it was stolen. That would be a larceny because I didn't really see or have it taken from me with bodily force, but it disappeared off my person due to somebody taking it. And often this is broken down at over and under $50 as a kind of thing. And theft is the stealing of it from the person as opposed to from the property. So I would have had a theft, actually. Larceny wouldn't have been taken.
If it came out of your pocket, it was theft.
Right. Robbery and burglary, what we were talking about last time, and those were sort of the class, I mean, those are the two crimes that people worry about the most in both cases, is you've got about 1% of those crimes leading to somebody serving some time in prison. Okay? Any other questions about this before we...
No. Just an observation. It seems like people who have been into burglaries, they have a pretty good listing on those people. And it seems to me that they catch them if they do two or three, because I've known fellows that get caught again and again. They seem to have a handle on the guy when he's been convicted or, you know, these fellows get caught pretty quickly, it seems like.
It depends, you know, there are different, well, let me respond to what you're saying. Lots of kids who burglarize do it too much, and they run out of freebies. They run out of chances because they're sloppy and they're silly, and they'll go down an alley until they find an open garage or they find an open back door, and then they'll go back to the same alley the next day and they'll keep going, or they'll brag about it to their friends, or they'll have the property. And so, I mean, I remember a friend in Evanston who saw their bike go by, you know. I mean, they're not thinking in a very professional way about this thing. So that there are lots of people who commit lots of these crimes will eventually get caught. But a huge proportion won't. I mean, a huge proportion are kids who basically just stop as they get older. Either they get scared or... they get a job or they get married or they do something that kind of brings them more into the mainstream. Quite a few of the people that end up serving time in prison, for example, who serve time for burglary, will be people that have tremendously long records and have done a huge amount, and eventually time just runs out on them.
If you suspect somebody and report that to the police, how responsible are you for... for being wrong.
Yeah, I don't think you're responsible at all. And I think that's actually, I mean, there are lots of sort of hotlines and different sort of anonymous call-in kinds of things, which I, again, can't do any harm, and may give the police a handle on something that they didn't have before. I was reading someplace recently that lots of the drug dealers that are in competition with each other will turn each other in on the hotline to do in their competition. You know, they'll say there's a buy at such and such a place, and or this guy's got a lot of cocaine in his house, and so forth and so on. Okay. Yeah.
I'm curious why the percentage that's reported is so low. And how do you know it's so low if it wasn't reported? It seems like, you know, how do you know what 100% was?
Right. One of the great improvements in criminal justice research in the last 15 years has been what they call victimization surveys. And what these are massive surveys every 6 months all over the United States that ask people, in the last 6 months, have these things happened to you? And that's how we pick up the estimates of the total amount of crime before it's reported. And that's given us a whole new handle on what used to it's called the business, the dark figure of crime, that unknown amount of crime that you can't get from official reports. And as you might guess, some of that crime is people felt it was, wasn't worth, you know, it was a minor kind of thing.
Car theft, I mean, you know, to have a third of people not bothering to report the car
and that's stolen. And that's very high. I mean, what the hard thing for us to process is what it's like in the sort of bottom quarter of the population where you don't have insurance, where maybe you, you know, the car's 15 years old already, where you may not have the proper registration on it, or you might not be, you know, there might be a law about insurance and you don't have it, or it's just not, you know, it's 15 years old and the heck with it, now that it's gone, you were sort of riding until it was going to collapse. So that happens a little higher up in the, and I did that myself. But that's one of the astounding things about, that's one of the things that's causing us to rethink in the crime and justice business, what the criminal justice system can do, because so much is not reported. People don't think it's going to do any good. They are nervous about the police because they may have an outstanding warrant themselves, or they'll feel the police might treat them unfairly. It's been so long since it's happened that they don't think it'll be do any good to call it in. There are some startling statistics. If you wait more than six, let's think about the burglaries. If you wait more than 6 minutes to call in a crime, it's almost sure that it won't be solved if you wait that long, unless you know who the person is. So it's that instantaneous reaction that really is the key to making the report useful. And you know, even with a burglary, you sort of walk into the house and you go, oh my goodness, and you kind of sit for a minute and then you look around, then you call your friend. Oh, and then you call the police. And if it's been something where there's physical violence or threat or you've been scared, all those things slow down your reactions. And the best thing the cops can do is, you know, hit, if it's a good police department, there'll be a massive show of force at the time of the call, if it's a crime in progress, and they have a good chance to catch that 17 or 18 year old kid running in some direction within that first 3 or 4 minutes. And then if they don't, it's pretty much history until they're picked up for something else and maybe will admit that they committed the crime. Yeah, it's sort of interesting, isn't it, to think about it this way. I mean, that's one of the reasons that we're sort of creeping up on general justice. I mean, it suggests to me that if we're going to do something about the crime problem, it's going to be through our own communities as much as it is through the criminal justice system. I mean, these figures, and you know, we're not even, we'll talk a little bit about the courts in a second, let you know that the police department is only going to touch a small percentage of the amount of crime in your neighborhood. And the notion, just to weave it back into the deterrence business, that there's any, I mean, let's leave out severity for a minute, that there's any certainty that if you do the crime, you'll end up doing the time, is silly. Because we're talking about unbelievably small amounts of information, so that even, I mean, leaving aside the kind of person that wants to get caught, and I think that there are people like that around, there's almost no chance of being apprehended, much less convicted, much less sent to prison, and we'll talk about that. So that the whole business of building it on this idea of severity and certainty begins to crack up when you look at the informational side of things. And it's not just a negative. I mean, the positive side of it, to me, and we'll talk about it more in the next couple of sessions, is that there are things that you can do in neighborhoods. There are things you can do in your churches and your voluntary organizations that are a way to attack this thing without relying on the criminal justice system. Yes, sir.
The apparently automobile theft in which they just learned is a chop shop. Would they be deterred quite a bit if the manufacturer had the same serial number as every part of the...
Well, that's a good point, yeah. I think they probably would. Although, I mean, it's sort of like locks, though. For every great lock that the lock companies invent, you know, within 24 hours, the lock busters have figured out a way to get around it. I mean, there is so much profit to be made in stolen parts that there's a high incentive to come up with some way to work the system. Most of this stuff, though, and car theft may be somewhat of an exception, most of this stuff, you're talking about amateurs. You're talking about conflictual situations, passions getting out of control, kids with nothing to do and not a very solid value system undergirding them, and not only no certainty, not much of a probability that the activities are going to lead to costs, that are they're really going to impair that kid in some kind of way that's going to make it not worth his while to do this kind of stuff. Again, 90% of the crime is property, and we're talking about less than 1% of those crimes coming up with a positive identification. So they aren't calculating much, but the extent to which they're calculating a pretty good shot at not even being identified, much less arrested. Yeah.
Would you explain the term citizen's arrest, that term that people use? When can a citizen, what is that?
I don't recommend it. Bird, you might do a better job of it than I.
It's without a warrant, and the citizen must see the crime and act immediately to take the person into custody. As Dan said, it's not always a very good idea to try and do that.
How do you do it, even?
Well, you have to overpower them in some sort of way so that they go along with you. I don't mean it's my least favorite kind of idea. I mean, I can remember friends of mine being so infuriated by some traffic violation, you know, that they sort of chased somebody down. But after they thought about it, they thought, well, what if he got a gun or if he was high or, you know, what if... And they hopefully think twice about it the second time they try to do it.
The point is, you see, usually if you hold someone, that you are retaining them free passage. It's a false arrest, and you could be liable for holding them. But if you allege that they have committed a crime which you have seen, and you stop them in order to be sure they don't get away, and you're willing to file charges later and so forth, then you are relieved of responsibility for false arrest.
But in the case of a teenager, if you had two men who could grab the person no. and detain him, it might be well.
Yeah, it might be. On the other hand, sometimes you get surprised. Jane and I were sitting in the quiet of our own home one Christmas Eve, was it, and our neighbors were gone on vacation. I had my shoes off. It was snowing lightly outside our room. I heard a noise. It sounded like something was happening in my neighbor's house, so I grabbed a poker and went dashing out in the snow. My Teddy Roosevelt waving the poker, and I crested between the shrubbery between the two houses. I'm sure there were 15 kids down there trying to break in the neighbor's door. Then you feel like, what am I
doing? That's right. The movie cameras aren't on. You notice that there's nobody watching.
I gotta put my shoes on. That's right.
Even with a poker. Almost especially with a poker, because if you've got some kind of weapon, then you're posing even more of a threat if you're sort of running.
On the other hand, they are so amateurish, they all ran. You know,
did they? I mean, is that what happened?
Yes, they did. Yeah. I pulled some kids over one night. I see them when they were driving along, and I see these kids pounding on somebody in the back seat. So I forced their car over into the meeting strip. It was just there was a car full of teenagers. And so I said, I'm going to pull you in. But the boy who was driving was very, very polite, and he apologized for it. He said, we're just forcing them in. I said, well, how do I know that you just by saying that. But anyway, I think the amateurish stuff that's going on, if we call some of that, you know, and make them accountable, that's kind of the difference in an anonymous society.
Right.
So much of this is going on. When I was a kid, we didn't have cars, and somebody a mile away would spot me doing something wrong, he'd stop me right on the spot, you know, and say, I'm going to tell your dad or something like that, but that's gone. Those controls are gone in this society.
Yeah. I'd be nervous about saying as a rule it's good to...
Yeah, I'm sure too. After I stopped him, I said, what am I
Right, right. The classic is, I'm going to have my dad talk to your dad, and the other guy says, don't be silly, your dad is my dad.
Okay. Just to get you a little more depressed, we'll find the silver lining in another day or two. When you look at the crimes against persons, which are the ones where we have more information, of those that are arrested, by and large, only half are indicted. That is to say, only half of those who are arrested, the prosecutor from your local county or jurisdiction will decide to go to court with. And of those that are indicted, only a third are convicted. So we're talking about, again, there is a lot of variation here from city to city and from county to county, but let's say there are 50 people are convicted, the way they got convicted is that 48 of them, as we say in the business, copped a plea, that is to say, they agreed to plead guilty to a lesser charge than the one they were charged with in order to avoid the court case and usually to do less time. So that even when we get to the point of it getting into the courts, where there is a good case, as far as the prosecutor can say, he's got to negotiate, I would say 80% to 90% of those convictions by negotiating with the lawyer for the kid that's, or the adult that's in trouble. So there's no jury. I mean, we're not talking about a system here that operates with 12 good and honest men and women taking a look at the evidence and deciding whether this person did or did not do it. We're talking about a system in which the prosecutor and the public defender sit down and they say, okay, he's charged with theft. He'll agree to plead guilty to larceny, which has a lesser amount of time that he might spend in prison or a lesser amount of time that he'd have to serve in order to avoid the trial. And they would agree to that, and then hopefully they would take that agreement to the judge, and the judge would say, that sounds fine, which is what he usually says, or that's not a reasonable agreement, go back and work on it some more. Only in about 10% of the cases is there a trial. So let's say there were 40 here and there are 10 here. These 10 go to trial. You're not going to do very well if you're the. You're going to do very well if you're the citizen, because in about 60% of the, or maybe even higher, 60% of the time, when it does go to trial, the person's convicted, and in about 40% or maybe even less than that, they are let off. So once you get to the point, once the person who is charged gets to the point of going to trial, there's a very, very, very high likelihood that they will be convicted. But not through what we would consider a fair trial, rather through a negotiation. And the reason for that is just the huge amount of cases that have to be dealt with. And that's why so many cases are dropped earlier. The prosecutor doesn't want to waste the judge's time or the public defender's time or anybody or his own time trying to take a case to court that he may not win, because there are 20 cases that he can do a plea negotiation on and be sure to win and get something, have the person punished somewhat, rather than taking a chance of getting nothing by going to court a lot and then not being able to process the mammoth amount of cases that there are.
Yeah. This may not be the right time to ask the question, but how does this compare with the countries of England, Scandinavian countries, say the European, or the European countries?
I don't know. Anyway, I don't have an answer, so it's not a bad time to answer. Well, do you have any idea what the...
Certainly not specifically. The general answer is that we have a lot more volume than most of those countries do, and we attempt to prosecute more. England, most of Europe tends to settle out even more than we do.
So, and the irony here, to get back to the deterrence business, is that these people that plea bargain ultimately aren't being punished for what they did. They're being punished for this negotiated deal. So even at that point, in the terms of justice, the offender, who may or may not have actually done the particular thing that they were charged with, ends up serving time for something that may not be related at all, well, related somewhat, to what they actually did. Mm-hmm. So their feeling of injustice begins to grow here too, because the guy whose charges were dropped against may have been just as guilty, but the family the guy that he robbed may have left the state or gotten scared and not decided to be a witness. Or, we can all think of lots of reasons. So there's nothing just in who actually is charged and indicted most of the time. It's really a roll of the dice, depending on the nature of the incident and how much information, again, there is about the incident, and less on who really deserves to be prosecuted. So the injustice then begins to creep in on the offender side too, because again, not only isn't it certain, but it may be quite severe and unrelated to what they actually had been about. Okay? So what we're getting here is that even if they get into the system and get arrested, about 80% of the time, they won't be convicted. And that means that the criminal justice system, within its own context, is doing as good a job as it can. But the massive amount of cases that they have to deal with and the limitations they have in terms of their information and their own managerial objectives, that's just keep the cases flowing, to not clog up the courts, means that they dispense justice within their own context as well as they can, but with very limited impact on the overall crime problem. And that's the dreary side of the news when you think about what can you do about the crime problem. The dilemma for a citizen, for just folks like us, is that the whole debate about what to do about crime has focused on the criminal justice side. We don't talk very much about the community. We don't talk very much about what the citizen can do outside of this reporting, being a witness, testifying, and so forth. And yet this apparatus is woefully inadequate to get at the deterring that we really need to have happen if something's going to change. The way things change now are mostly what we call in the business demographics. That is to say, the base, the pool of kids that commit these crimes is going down. The number of 16 to 24 year olds, as you all, you know, we're an aging society now. So there are fewer of them. So that means that there are fewer in that 100% category at the top in terms of the amount of victimizations. And so that's the major way that we're making a dent in the crime problem currently. It's just less kids around to be doing all the bad stuff. Now everybody takes credit for that in different kinds of ways, and there's no politician around who won't claim some of the praise for reducing the crime. But one of the, I don't want to make this thing too dreary, one of the exciting things about that victimization category is that it's at its lowest point in the last 12 years. That in about 1981, correlated with the Reagan administration, so that may have something to do with the Reagan administration, in about 1981, those crimes started to drop. And again, remember, it's mostly the property crimes that we're talking about. So that when you look at these victimization studies nationally, and it's going to vary from town to town, and county to county, we are at the lowest point in the total amount of crime in the United States that we've been at in the last 12 years. And that's nothing to sneeze at, except that my judgment is, and everybody's entitled to their own opinion, it doesn't have much to do with the criminal justice system. It's just got a lot to do with how many people there are in that pool that commit those crimes. And even a 12%, it's 12 years, I'm not sure, can't remember exactly how, what the percentage is. It's around the 12% drop. Even that drop doesn't make a dent into this processing kind of system that we've got now, so that when we go to look for our own capacity to do something about the crime thing, not only in terms of protecting ourselves, but also giving a message about what values we are reinforcing and what values we are trying to exemplify, our criminal justice system just sputters along at a very low level of manifesting those values in terms of the kinds of changes and impacts it can have on who's doing all this bad stuff. And these victimization studies have been one of the ways that we've gotten a better look at this whole picture. Yeah?
Seems to be a correlation between the burglaries and personal drug addictions. And I'm wondering if there's any statistics or any studies on whether we're making a dent in plugging up some of the massive supplies of drugs that get into the community and addictions and the burglaries.
I really don't know. I mean, I could guess, but I wouldn't be any more informed than anybody else's guess about it. So much of what we do in this crime, so much of what a citizen has to do in this crime business is rely on the media. And the media tells a story that's about news, not about information. So my guess about the drug business is based on what I read in Newsweek and Time and places like that, and not based on any harder information than that. So I can't give you a good answer about it. Any other questions or comments on this piece of the story?
You've already said, Dan, that how expensive this whole business is. I'll back up on that idea. If this state is typical at all, over half of our court time now, half of our criminal cases, even with that very, very modest number, that would be, I think, Representative State of Washington, too. Half of every judge, every court clerk, half of everything spent on this. If we ever brought in all those cases that were up there, we'd have to spend all of our money on the court system we couldn't afford.
And that's one of the things that the criminal, I mean, in private, people in the criminal justice system will discuss it all the time. They're in the business of rationing their resources. Every day they have 100 cases to choose from, and they have to choose two. They have to decide which ones to go after, which ones to pursue. Some of it's political, some of it is moral, some of it is self-interested, but they're choosing out of a huge array of problems what it is that they really want to pursue. And that's in some, I mean, that's what we call in the business discretion, meaning we're relying on the judgments of other people to pursue the directions that we want to pursue in the criminal justice system. This isn't all dreary, because I think if you look at lots of other systems in our society, you find the same kind of thing. Let's, for a minute, so that we end on a positive note, and I can give you a hint about where I want to go in the next couple of sessions, think a little bit about the health system and the medical field. If I ask you what keeps you healthy, or what makes somebody healthy, you'll say right off the bat, well, good medical treatment. And I'll say, yes, that's right. And I'll say, what else? And you'll say, well, habits. If I learn to eat well, learn to take care of myself, that's part of it. And I'll say, that's right. And I'll say, what else keeps you healthy? And you'll say, resources. If I have the money to buy good food, if I can live in an area that there aren't any environmental hazards in, that's important. And I think you can begin to think about security that way too. What keeps us secure? Well, some of it's the criminal justice system. But there are other pieces of it too. There are your habits. There are both the habits that you have in terms of how you live your life, and also the habits you inculcate in your kids. There are the resources that you have. There are the environments that you live in. Health and security are similar kinds of values in our society. They are values that we tend to think about in professional terms. It's something that a doctor gives us, it's something that a policeman gives us. But when we pursue it a little bit deeper in our own thoughts, we recognize that there's lots that we do that produce those same things. And one way to think about general justice and improving the crime and justice problem in the United States is to think about security the way we think about health. To think about the things that we do for ourselves that keep us healthy and keep us secure. With all due respect to the medical establishment, it hasn't made a huge dent in the death rates for most people. That is to say, when we lick some sanitation problems, when we lick some infectious disease problems, at the beginning of this century, we changed the rates at which people were dying, and we extended people's lives. And improvements in what we were eating, improvements in the environment and in sanitation, all of those things are increasing life expectancy. The CAT scan is an important tool, but it's an important tool for a very small number of people. And the same can be thought of in terms of criminal justice. The criminal justice system has taught us to rely on it as the way to remain secure, has taught us that they have skills and expertise that can keep us safe, that if we just rely on them and just rely on their fancy computers and give them more resources like the CAT scan, we'll be better off. These kinds of numbers show you the limitations of what the criminal justice professions can do, and we're also beginning in our own minds to see the limitations of what the health professions can do. I mean, we're all thinking a lot more carefully now, especially after being at Holden, about what we eat and whether we exercise and the ways we take care of ourselves, what kind of environments we put ourselves into. Everybody's very, very interested now with the quality of the air and so forth, and the kinds of waste disposal that's going on and toxics and all that kind of stuff. That kind of thinking can be used for criminal justice. That kind of thinking can be used about security. How safe you are is largely a function of how you live, who you live with, what kinds of habits you develop and what kinds of habits you pass on to other people. And if you can begin with sort of living healthier yourself and living more secure yourself, then communities can build safer environments. Now, it doesn't mean you throw the police away. Doesn't mean you throw the prosecutor or the prison away. But it means that you begin thinking about security and you begin thinking about justice as something you produce. Not something you consume that a professional gives you, but something you produce in the way you live and the way your community is organized. And that gives you back some capacities to do some things about these problems. It doesn't mean we get rid of CAT scans. It doesn't mean we throw away our criminal justice system. It means that it's a supplement. It's an ancillary supplement to the main parts of our lives and the habits that we develop, the values that we believe in, and the way we go about our lives. And that security can be like health, and I would say is like health, in the sense that it's those habits, those resources, those environments that produce security, just as it is that those habits and resources and environments produce our health. And if we begin to think that way, then lots of possibilities open up for a more gentle kind of justice that we can begin to build in the way we live and extend that out to those around us. Now, somebody accused me of the first day of being utopian. I'm not sure it's utopian. I'm not sure that we can afford not to be utopian. All these professional systems cost a huge amount of money, and they're not great at giving us the kinds of results we need, and we can begin to think ourselves about taking back some of the control that can produce some of the security that we're all so vitally interested in. It's not something that a cop can give us alone. It's something that we give ourselves by the way we live. And that's I'll leave you with that thought, and then next time I'll talk a little bit about prisons, and then on the last day I'll talk some about crime prevention and the kinds of things we can do. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you.